Ben, on a la surprise d'avoir une conférence un petit peu surprise, justement, avec James Morrow, puisqu'elle n'était pas tout à fait prévue au programme, mais comme Tim Powers n'a pas pu être des nôtres, James Morrow a accepté avec plaisir eh bien, qu'on fasse une heure avec James Morrow, et ça me fait vraiment plaisir parce que c'est un auteur tout simplement passionnant, James Morrow. On va pouvoir avoir un petit peu de temps pour en discuter ensemble. Mais si vous ne l'avez pas encore, n'hésitez pas à prendre un petit casque pour avoir la traduction en français. Vous les trouverez juste derrière la première colonne. Voilà. Alors, pour présenter James Morrow, on va parler un petit peu de ses romans. James Morrow est né en 1947. On le définit, et il se définit lui-même comme humaniste scientifique. Alors on va en discuter un petit peu avec lui. Parmi les œuvres qu'on peut retenir, il y a bien sûr Le vin de la violence, La cité de vérité, L'arbre à rêve, Notre mère qui est aux cieux. Mais il y a aussi la trilogie Jéhovah, avec notamment En remorquant Jéhovah, qui a été publiée en 1994. Puis deux romans un petit peu plus près de nous. En 2006, Le dernier chasseur de sorcières. Et puis en 2009, il vient d'être édité par Le Diable Vauvert. C'est L'apprenti du philosophe. James Morrow, première question un petit peu pour qu'on puisse dresser un petit peu votre portrait. Lorsque vous étiez enfant, lorsque vous étiez adolescent, vous étiez déjà un lecteur. Vous avez beaucoup lu à ce moment-là.
I'd have to say that my arrival as a science fiction author is from the bottom up, not from the top down. I became intrigued by this genre and the marvelous toolkit that every science fiction writer is issued when you decide to take up this trade, by way of Hollywood horror movies. I was a great fan of Forrest J. Ackerman's magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland. And it's the science fiction genre is often accused of being escapist. Parents worry that if their kids devour pulp fiction or Hollywood movies about alien invasions, they won't ever be able to come to terms with reality. I think something like the opposite is really the case. For me, science fiction is not escape, it's arrival. When I first saw King Kong's Island on my black and white, my parents' black and white television set, when the movie was revived in the 1950s, I said, I belong there, I belong on Skull Island. I felt the same way about Victor Frankenstein's laboratory. You know, I belong there. This was arrival. This was not escape. I understood these works not as trivial entertainment, but as philosophical. I immediately identified with these monsters, with Frankenstein's creation, with King Kong. I knew there was something about them in me. They spoke to me in a sort of wordless language. It was only when I reached high school that I began to read voraciously. I didn't put my horror movies and my comic books, my bande dessinée away, but I did graduate to the sort of philosophical fiction that informs and influences my science fiction. I read philosophical novelists, and it's no coincidence that my most recent publication, my most recent novel, is The Philosopher's Apprentice, L'Apprenti du Philosophe.
Vous parliez des parents. L'ambiance, c'était comment à la maison? On vous a laissé lire de la science-fiction, ou au contraire, vous en avez lu contre leur avis?
They were actually pretty supportive of my addiction. My friends and I were so inspired by the science fiction we read, the movies we saw mostly on television, that we began to make our own films. And in my closet to this day is the adaptation of The Telltale Heart that my friend George and I made in high school. We managed to, these were shot on 8mm film, a gauge that is completely vanished, older even than Super 8. 8mm movie film was actually 16mm movie film that you exposed in two different runs through the, passes through the camera, a wind-up, key-driven camera. And then you sent it off to the lab, and they would slit the film down the middle and splice the two ends together, and you had like 5 minutes of a scene from, you know, we made The Telltale Heart, we did an adaptation of Coleridge's The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, we did an adaptation of an August Derleth horror story called The Return of Andrew Bentley. And my mother, God bless her, thought it was pretty cool that her son was doing this. And we would show these movies in my parents' living room. Our house wasn't very big, so all these children from the neighborhood would crowd into the living room. And my mother made popcorn, and she got into it. So she was not trying to steer me away from that. I'd also credit my mother with being my first publisher. When I was 7 years old, I became, I was possessed by the need to tell stories. And I remember pacing around the dining room, dictating a story about a family of talking dogs. And my mother dutifully typed it up using a battered old typewriter that she'd inherited from some wealthier relative. So I like to say my current publisher, Don Les Etats-Unis, my current American publisher is William Morrow, but my first publisher was Emily Morrow, my mother.
Quels sont les auteurs à cette époque-là qui vous ont particulièrement marqué, les premiers auteurs par lesquels vous êtes rentré en littérature et en science-fiction?
As I was saying, my trajectory is a little different, maybe, than the typical career of a science fiction author. I didn't grow up reading a great deal of science fiction. There are a few touchstones for me. Heinlein's, Robert Heinlein's Have Space Suit, Will Travel, moved me very much when I was perhaps 12 years old. But it was really encountering, through a wonderful course I took in the 10th grade in high school, dans lycée, encountering great philosophical literature. We read Franz Kafka's The Trial. We read L'Étranger de Albert Camus. We read Madame Bovary. We read The Inferno by Dante. And I was particularly moved by Voltaire's Candide. And I came out of that course saying, literature is not simply about vicarious involvement in the lives of non-existent people. Literature is a dance of ideas. Literature enables you to have thoughts you'd never imagined having. You have thoughts you never had before. And I said, that's for me. Sign me up. I want to be part of that grand project of the fiction of ideas, the fiction of knowledge. And I realized that with my satiric sensibility, I could perhaps be something of an American Voltaire. I mean, for me, Voltaire's Micromegas is the absolute touchstone of our genre. Everything that's valuable about science fiction, the perspective that it gives you on human follies and foibles, is in that petit conte, that petit roman de Monsieur Voltaire. And I also, of course, responded to the American satiric writers, Mark Twain, Kurt Vonnegut Jr. I didn't want to confine myself to the mainstream. I loved what I earlier called the toolkit that the genre of science fiction provides its practitioners. You can travel through time. You can use a robot as an analog for the human dilemma. You can discover lost civilizations. And all of those tropes and tools, for me, demand thought experiments. The great question of science fiction, what if? So for my very first novel, I asked, what if there was a society that was totally pacifist, a world in which no one had ever been robbed or murdered or raped? This is my book, The Wine of Violence, Le Vin de la Violence. And initially, it's a mystery story. How in the world did this utopia come about? And is it really a utopia? What kind of trade-offs have they made? If you turn yourself into a pacifist, have you perhaps robbed yourself of some sort of primal, vital, reptilian juice? And I like to think the novel plays with that problem in interesting ways. The solution to the mystery, if you've read it, is that people, in fact, are born with an aggressive instinct, but they siphon off the violent impulse, the dark instinct, by projecting themselves into television dramas. You can plug your brain directly into tableaus that are artificial, sort of a anticipation of virtual reality, I think.
Parlez-nous un petit peu de vos premières expériences en écriture et surtout de votre premier roman publié. Comment ça s'est passé concrètement? Vous aviez un peu plus de 30 ans lorsque votre premier roman a été publié. Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé avant? Est-ce que vous écriviez, mais vous n'avez pas encore soumis des manuscrits? Qu'est-ce qui a été le déclic?
Well, going back to pacing around in my family living room, dictating crazy stories to my mother, not simply the talking dog story. That was the first. A real collector's item. But I would do adventure stories that were perhaps reminiscent of Jules Verne. And I then left the medium of fiction at age 8. But I didn't lose my drive, my need to tell stories. So I have some drawing ability, so I did bande dessinée, made my own comic books for several years. That satisfied the urge. My friends and I in junior high school would put on plays, horror stories, ghost stories that I wrote and I convinced my friends to act out. And I mentioned then the next medium for me was filmmaking. But yes, it was not until I was 28 years old that I circled back to fiction. I continued making films through college and into adulthood. For a while, I earned my living making documentary movies for the public schools in Philadelphia. Sort of propaganda films celebrating how great the innovative programs were that were happening in the late 1960s in public education in Philadelphia. But then one day, perhaps as a result of being so involved in the world of public education, I said to myself, what if, I mean, I understand there is a critique of the mass media. And particularly in the late 1960s, people were very worried about children becoming addicted to television. There was a famous book, at least in Les États-Unis, by a writer named Marie Wynne. It was called The Plug-In Drug. And it was a no-holds-barred indictment of television, of broadcast television. I said to myself, well, I don't know if that's true or not. Television for me was very important to my sensibility. It gave me a sense, a narrative sense, and some skill, I think, with telling stories. I would credit the visual media as much as the print media with that faculty of mine. So I'm not sure I buy this notion that television is ipso facto bad for kids. And I said, well, and let me really give the devil his due. Let me really be the devil's advocate. What if television is serving a very benevolent function? What if it's a very public-spirited medium and siphons off aggressive impulses that one might otherwise have to enact, to act out in the real world? So that led to my utopia / dystopia. It's called Quetzalia in Lavin de la Violence, where people connect themselves to their television. And if you've had a really bad day at the office, your employer was mean to you, you can go home, connect yourself to a scene on television in which your boss is there, and then you can enter the scene and you can strangle him. You can take out all of your violent aggressions, all of your dark impulses on the boss, and nobody really gets hurt. And there's a case to be made that television does have this cathartic function. Maybe it's better that people are put out of commission by watching soccer, football, and rather, you know, they might otherwise have the need to beat up on somebody in the street. I don't know. Nobody knows. The human mind is far more complicated than any psychologist's theory.
On vous définit comme un humaniste scientifique, peut-être à la frontière entre la science-fiction et la philosophie. Dès le départ, c'est ce que vous aviez envie de faire et d'écrire?
The science part comes late for me. I had a very bad science education dans lycée. In high school, my chemistry teacher, my biology teacher, I'd have to say they were pretty clueless. They did not fire me with the passion. I came to realize that science is a very human enterprise, and biology and chemistry and physics are every bit as much humanities, and they belong every bit as much in that under that rubric of the humanities as literature and painting and music do. But this secret was kept from me by my high school teachers. It was only while I was in college in the cité, Grand Cité de Philadelphie, in Philadelphia, that I got interested in some people who lived not too far from the university who worked on brain research, and they were trying to develop innovative therapies that would help children with severe brain injuries, and they had some theories that I think were pretty valid. Not ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, which is a discredited argument in biology, but the notion that you could maybe help a child with so-called cerebral palsy, a child with a midbrain injury, by having the child recapitulate the normal mobility stages that a baby and then an infant and then a preschooler goes through. So they would have children with cerebral palsy go back to the phase of crawling on the belly, on the stomach. And then comes the stage of creeping, where the infant is moving on hands and knees. And then walking in. And of course, we still retain our Darwinian heritage. We're still four-legged. I mean, if you think about the way a human being walks, it's in this cross pattern in which all four legs are involved, okay? And that echo of four-legged mobility was something they invited children with midbrain injuries to mimic as well as they could. And this institution it's called the Institute for the Achievement of Human Potential. They did attract, even though their theories were controversial, some very, very interesting scientists. I got to meet at this clinic Raymond Dart, the South American anatomist who discovered and named the very first Australopithecine. Raymond Dart gave the name Australopithecine africanus to the famous Tong baby, that female baby who is arguably not a direct human ancestor, but certainly on the grand tree, the grand Darwinian tree, and you could follow our own roots back there. So the passion with which these people pursued both theories of human evolution, theories of brain plasticity, theories of neurological organization, and then also their direct hands-on work with the hurt children, that made science real for me. And I said, oh, this, I love this way of being in the world. It's rational. It doesn't appeal to the supernatural. It doesn't rely on some authority who knows God's opinions on every subject under the sun, setting you straight, telling you how the universe works. It's dependent on the bright side of science, curiosity, a discourse that is always open-ended, questions that are always vulnerable to revision as we learn more. So, I mean, for me, science is simply, it's Latin source, it's Latin etymology, knowledge. And I think of science fiction as therefore nothing but knowledge fiction, a discourse about that understanding of reality. I would never claim that science exhausts reality. I'm very taken with the profound distinction that I believe I'm correctly crediting to Aristotle, the distinction between the necessary and the sufficient. There was a rencontre earlier today about philosophy as this natural father of science fiction. Science fiction, I guess, is the stepchild of philosophy, and that's how my own brain works. So I think the scientific, rational, secular understanding of reality is necessary. My roman, the Last Witchfinder, Le Dernier Chasseur de Sorcières, is a celebration of the coming of the Age of Reason. It's about the birth of the Enlightenment. But I would never say that that's sufficient. There's always mysteries beyond the material. For me, they're aesthetic and artistic mysteries. They're not spiritual mysteries, but I'll grant that maybe there's a supernatural stratum to the universe. I've personally seen no evidence of it, but who am I? I'm just a crummy science fiction writer. I'm not God. I'm not even an angel.
C'est pour ça que dans Le Dernier Chasseur de Sorcières, vous avez mis en scène Newton, justement, et Benjamin Franklin. Pourquoi ces personnages et pourquoi ce 18e siècle?
You know, there was, I guess going back 8 years, for some reason, a whole spate of science fiction that looked back to the Age of Reason. Neal Stephenson's, was it a quintet or that enormous project of, I forget the title of that. Pardon me, the
Cryptonomicon, peut-être.
Cryptonomicon. No, after that he followed. It was a huge quartet of novels about the yes. What? The Baroque cycle. Yes, the Baroque cycle. The alchemy series that in which ran over four novels that was done by a writer whose name escapes me at the moment, that was about the premise. This is wonderful alternative history. What if Isaac Newton's celestial mechanics? What if his physics had not been the case? But what if Newton's alchemical investigations had turned out to map onto reality? This was J. Gregory Keynes, yes, okay. So something was in the air, something was in the water that had we science fiction writers, and in a sense going back to our roots, there was also in the culture at that time, and sad to say it persists to this day, I think a rejection of reason. The administration of George Bush was, at one level, a repudiation of the Enlightenment. We're not beholden to experience. We're not beholden to evidence. We make reality. And so it was a kind of faith-based political administration. And I think the disasters of the Bush years can be traced to that rejection of the rational faculty. Really, the hatred of science, Bush deciding that creationism, or the euphemism that's used for creationism, is is the case. You know, we must, and the denial of. Of course, the denial of climate change. So I think we wanted to recover and celebrate this precious moment in history. Intelligent design, that's what I was trying to think of. I hate to tell intelligent design so much that I repress even its name. We were trying to recover that precious moment in history when... people looked at each other, thinkers, men and women, women in their philosophical salons, men in their laboratories, looking at each other and saying, you know, maybe we've just been thrown onto this planet without a rule book. Maybe religious revelation is yet another product of human imagination. And that means we're kind of on their own. We're on our own. That's terrifying, but it's also energizing. It's not clear exactly how Voltaire is using the word optimism in the subtitle. To Candide, it's both satirical. I mean, clearly he's mocking the naive optimism of Candide. And the absurd rationalizations that Dr. Pangloss brings to every catastrophe that's visited upon him. At the same time, Voltaire and Benjamin Franklin and Montesquieu and these other characters who ended up in my novel, even Isaac Newton in his own sort of crotchety way, they believe in progress. They are meliorists. They imagine things getting better as a function of human ingenuity, as a function of science, as a function of progress. To be sure, the Enlightenment has its critics, and those critics are worth listening to. It's a mistake to turn reason into its own sort of religion, and I guess this is the postmodern critique of the Enlightenment, really rejection of the Enlightenment. And exhibit A in this argument, of course, is always the French Revolution. Well, okay, yes, it's a problem. But I still think to follow George Bush down the path of rejecting Darwin, rejecting science as ipso facto blasphemous, is a recipe for disaster. I guess I would paraphrase Winston Churchill. Reason, I would say, is the worst possible mode in which to negotiate the world, except for all the others.
Je voudrais faire une petite parenthèse parce que le temps file vite, il est déjà 45. Une petite parenthèse sur la nouvelle qui a été publiée dans l'anthologie des Utopiales sur le Titanic, qui est une uchronie. Comment est-ce que vous avez imaginé ces passagers qui s'organisent pour se sauver du naufrage?
I went to see the James Cameron movie, Titanic, which I thought was a dreadful movie. But made with a great deal of technical expertise. I thought the story was silly and trivialized. The real narrative of the Titanic, I mean, there's a story of hubris, and which is, of course, the pitfall that those of us who are of the scientific humanist persuasion, we always have to be careful of hubris. That's the real story of why the Titanic went down. It wasn't the iceberg. It was an overreaching ambition. But I came out of the movie saying, particularly looking at the scenes near the end where people are floating around on the flotsam and jetsam of the wreck, and of course, as we all know, the problem with that disaster was not the possibility of drowning. Virtually everyone had a life vest. It was one problem and one problem only: the temperature of the water. You're going to freeze to death. And I said, I came out of that saying, you know, if that's the only problem that had to be solved, I guess I was trying to think like a science fiction writer, maybe a little bit, tried to be a little bit of Robert Heinlein's Competent Man. If that was the problem, you just have to keep people out of the water for perhaps as few as 4 hours, because they know they've raised the Carpathia. They know that one of the ships that they sent the distress signal to answered. Perhaps 4 hours, perhaps 6 hours, the Carpathia, and indeed the Carpathia behaved in an exemplary fashion. It went after them full speed. The ship that was actually very nearby, the California, behaved in a detestable fashion. The captain shut off the radio room, you know, at midnight. And of course, they strike the iceberg early in the morning. So the people keeping on watch on the deck of the California see these distress flares go up, and they think, oh, it's fireworks. It's some ritual that the White Star Line enacts every once in a while when a ship's on its maiden voyage. They shoot up distress signals. What a terrible misreading. But I said, you know, if they'd built a raft, if they'd thrown everything they could into the water and tried to lash it together, the grand staircase, and maybe used the lifeboats, not to save an elite few, but as pontoons for the raft, it might have worked. You just had to keep people out of the water. The British like to congratulate themselves on how nobly everyone behaved. And indeed, many members of the upper class, many aristocrats, saved themselves. Nevertheless, more first-class passengers survived than third-class children. So it's not really the brightest chapter in the history of l'Angleterre. And I actually had occasion to run my theory past an associate of Jim Cameron's, who is a science fiction writer, Charles Pellegrino, an American science fiction writer. He's collaborated with George Zebrowski and wrote his own book about the disaster called Her Name, Titanic. And I said, Charlie, might this have worked? And he wrote back and said, and he actually has considerable scientific knowledge. He actually accompanied Ballard on the voyage that found the wreck of the Titanic. He said, yes, Jim, I think that would have worked. Then, of course, I do weird James Morrow satirical things. Once they're afloat, they decide, the passengers on my raft of the Titanic decide they prefer being there to being back home. They like life on the raft. I mean, back home, the Great War is getting up to speed, right? They don't want any parts of that. They're kind of happy on their raft, so they just stay there. So it becomes a kind of utopian story.
Vos romans et vos histoires sont très riches. On vient de parler de cette nouvelle-là. On n'a pas encore abordé la trilogie de Jéhovah et vos autres livres. Comment est-ce que vous travaillez? Comment est-ce que vous élaborez vos romans? Il y a une grosse phase de documentation. Comment ça se passe? Donnez-nous un peu vos secrets d'écrivain.
Well, as I said, for me, science fiction is the art of the thought experiment. And so I begin with a concept. And if I've set up experimental conditions that are sufficiently weird, sufficiently fecund, then something will precipitate out of that solution. So I begin with a premise such as, they've found the corpse of God floating in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and a supertanker captain has been commissioned to tow the Corpus Dei, the two-mile-long body of God, to its final resting place, a glacier in the Arctic that's been hollowed out as a tomb by some angels. And I said to myself, that's actually a terrible idea for a novel. That's embarrassingly bald. That's much too overt, I guess. But let me live with it for a while. So I began to write it, and I said, you know, actually, no, these experimental conditions are leading to some interesting scenes that I didn't envision at the beginning. I mean, for me, writing a novel is a little bit like jumping off a railroad bridge and landing on a freight train, and you don't know where you're going to end up. You know, you're going to end up somewhere if you do this somewhere in the continent of Europe, if you do it in La France, but you don't know. You know, it's a dance of, you set up an experiment, but then you have to be open to the results of the experiment. You don't predetermine those results. The experiment speaks to you. The puppets that you control, you're the marionette puppet master, but the puppets that ultimately have to get out their scissors and cut their strings and take on a life of their own. So I found in the case of Henri Marcon, Jehovah, in the case of Towing Jehovah, that there was an opportunity to have the most unusual Eucharist that I think has ever occurred in fiction, when the crew of the supertanker, who are trying to tow Jehovah to his final resting place, run aground on an uncharted island. They have no food. They're starving. They've lost the corpse when this island comes popping out of the ocean floor and the chains snap. The Corpus Dei floats away. And they're about to perish from famine. Then the corpse floats back, and they say, well, we have no choice but to feast upon this gift from God, the flesh. But it's going to be a Eucharist, but we better make it an inverse Eucharist. We better turn the communion service upside down. We must deconsecrate the flesh of God. And they happen to have a priest with them who's happy to do that. So I said, this is a richer premise than I thought. And by living inside this crazy experiment for perhaps 3 years, it took me that long to write the novel, I came to believe it. I came to believe that this odd state of affairs had actually come to pass.
Il nous reste une dizaine de minutes. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question pour Jess Moreau? Allez-y, profitez-en. C'est le moment. Eh ben moi j'en ai encore plein, voilà.
Or for Tim Powers, you could ask Tim Powers a question and I'll do my best to channel him.
Une question à Jess Moreau ou à Tim Powers alors? Personne? Simplement, aujourd'hui, quel regard vous portez un petit peu sur...
I got a lot of money from the Disney organization for the... for Pirates of the Caribbean, on Stranger Tides. That was a happy day for me.
une petite question. Comment vous regardez maintenant votre biographie? Quel regard vous avez sur votre carrière? Est-ce que vous en êtes satisfait?
Well, show me a practicing novelist and I'll show you somebody who's not satisfied with his career in toto. Sure, I wish I had more readers, but I'm not really complaining. I actually think I'm one of the luckiest writers on this particular planet because I've gotten to say what I want to say. Nobody's come to me and said, Jim, if you would give this a happy ending instead of the tragic endings that often are the case with your novels, we'd sell more books. Jim, if you would leave God alone and write steampunk instead, you know, then we, you know, you might become a superstar. But no, ever since, to sort of bring it full circle, ever since this was, I guess, a kind of inverse road to Damascus for me, ever since Voltaire and Camus and Dostoevsky and Franz Kafka and all of these free-thinking, contrarian philosophers, ever since they spoke to me from out of the heavens, I've been able to pursue my own project in my own modest way. So I think of that song, Chevalier de la Table Ronde, sur mon tombe, je veux qu'on inscrive. I wish that somebody would write on my tomb, not ici j'ai le roi des buveurs, not here lies the king of drinkers, but here lies James Morrow, a satirist and an author of science fiction.
Sur quoi est-ce que vous travaillez actuellement? Quel est votre prochain projet en cours?
My current project is something of a sequel to Le Dernier Chasseur de Sorcières, something of a sequel to Last Witchfinder, just as Witchfinder was a celebration of the coming of the Enlightenment. The Witchfinder was about the arrival of the Age of Reason and Le Siècle des Lumières. My new novel is about the coming of the Darwinian worldview. It's a celebration of Charles Darwin's amazing insight into the biosphere, the fact that, astonishing fact, that I think we're still reeling from, that we've not remotely come to terms with Darwin's understanding that everything that has ever lived and everything that's alive now and everything that ever will live is interconnected. There were no acts of separate and special creation that put one kind of tortoise on the Galapagos island called Charles and another kind of tortoise on the Galapagos island called Albemarle. It was all evolution. So it's a historical novel set mostly in the year 1815. In the interval between Darwin's return from Galapagos and his having articulated his theory and his publication in 1859 of Origin of Species. And the premise is that a group of Rakehell's free thinkers in Oxford are floating. They've put up a huge cash prize, 10,000 British pounds, to anybody who can prove or disprove the existence of God. My heroine, a fictional character named Chloe Bathurst, is working at Darwin's estate. She's a governess at Down House in County Kent. She's in charge not of Darwin's children, but in charge of the specimens, live animals that he brought back from Galapagos. There's a little bit of poetic license here. Darwin didn't really bring back these large terrestrial lizards or the aquatic iguanas or giant tortoises, but in my novel he does. So my heroine becomes aware of this very radical idea that's in the air at Darwin's estate that, you know, that there might have been just one primal act of creation and the book of Genesis is all wrong and there was no Adam, and if there was no Adam, then there was maybe no fall of man, and maybe that's a problem for the Christian argument about salvation. And so, and So she says, I'm going to take that argument to the Shelley Society and I'm going to win £10,000. The problem is she doesn't understand the theory very well because it's a complicated and subtle idea. I mean, the mechanism that Darwin discovered of natural selection and all the unimaginable amounts of death and extinction and copulation that undergird the theory and make it so plausible. So she says, well, Darwin won't lend me his specimens. Darwin won't let me take these live illustrations. So I have to go collect them myself. And so it becomes then an adventure story, a grand voyage across the Atlantic. And then she has to travel up the Amazon River. And finally, in a kind of Jules Verne airship, she travels to Galapagos to round up these animals and has many weird adventures along the way. So there's a touch of steampunk about this novel, now that I think about it.
On va remercier Jens Moreau d'avoir accepté cette conférence un petit peu surprise. Vous allez pouvoir le retrouver en dédicace. Une conférence Cyberland, le pays de l'imaginaire cérébral. Tout un programme aussi. Merci à vous et merci à Jens Moreau.
De rien, je vous en prie.